Okay. And share my screen. I just have a couple slides of news. Okay. Yep. I'll get started. So, welcome everyone to the FCCLP meeting. So I just have a couple slides of news. This slide, I think all the content you've already seen, but in case you haven't been in a meeting lately, I wanted to remind you because this is important. First, on the FCC report, the midterm report is available on the on CDS to all CERN users. It's at the link here. I don't know what the plan is for making it public to absolutely everyone, but I believe that's still in the plan. Then the final feasibility study report, the first draft of that needs to be ready by the end of the year. And we will have a version zero draft for internal FCC PED review by the end of September. So therefore, your drafts of your analysis notes need to be ready by early September. So that's the main deadline to keep in mind. And then, of course, the final report will be an official document, totally public and submitted to the European Strategy Report. And along with the strategy report, there's ECFA deadlines. In particular, there's the ECFA Higgs Factories workshop in Paris in early October, and the link to that agenda is here. So the ECFA deadlines are in time for this workshop. So basically by early September, you should be really finalizing your write-ups of what you're working on if you want it to be included in these reports. So for the FCC notes in general, again, copying the slides from the physics and performance meetings or the last several. They have like a common sense policy on publication of FCC related events. If it includes Monte Carlo and tools and statistics from the FCCE and has FCC in the title, you know, it should be reviewed by internally within the FCC collaboration. So it'd be good to have a detailed FCC note posted as well as a draft of the paper in CDS and presented in the physics and performance meeting at least once. And the physics and performance conveners will define reviewers for a speedy decision on the submission. So it's not as lengthy of a approval process as you might be used to from your LHC collaborations, but it is important to keep everyone involved and aware of your results. And we are a loose collaboration of the FCC. So several notes have apparently still been hanging there for months, and we'd like to get them published. I'm not sure this applies to any of us, but if so, let me know. Okay. I think my penultimate slide. There is a talk opportunity for the Hypo-Kamiokande experiment for an event that's happening at KIT in Karlsruhe in October. Actually, I think it overlaps with the ECFA meeting. But the idea is to talk about FCC with particular emphasis on the search for proton decays and other baryon number violating processes. But this could be relevant to heavy neutral leptons. So if you're interested in this talk opportunity, the link is here. Okay, so today we'll hear two talks, one from Tom about the DNN in the electron H&L channel. And so this is an update of ongoing work. And then the second presentation will be from Richards, talking in this group for the first time about feasibility studies for dark photon production in Higgs decays at the FCCE. Next week is FCC week in San Francisco, so we won't have this meeting next week. And I encourage you to follow the FCC week instead. There's a number of interesting talks that could be relevant to what we all are working on. I suggest you look at the agenda and search for BSM or H&L or similar keywords and find the talks you're interested in, if not other ones. iChEPX is coming up in July. There's many FCC talks and posters happening then, including I believe it's a talk from Niccolo on BSM physics and HNLs at the FCC. And then the ECFA workshop in Paris, I already mentioned, and there will be an FCC Italy France workshop in Venice in November. And remember, these are the links to the FCC full sim and FCC analyses meetings, as well as the FCC seminars, all of which could be of particular interest to all of us. And that's all I had. Questions on the news? Okay, I'm not seeing any. So then we can move to Tom.
Hello. I'll just
Hello.
try and share my slides. It's always a bit dodgy as to whether it works. So,
Okay, good luck.
do you see them?
Yes.
This is wonderful news. So,
Do you want to make them full screen?
yeah.
Oh.
If it lets me.
Well,
There we go.
it's pretty close to full screen, so if it doesn't work.
There we go. Is that
Okay,
okay?
great. Yep.
Great. So today I'm just going to be giving you an update on the electron digest final state of the HNLs at the FCC. And those of you that were at the last presentation may be aware that the focus of this study has been to optimize existing cut and count limits by using machine learning techniques. So far we've tried a BDT, and recently we've been trying to push this further or match the performance by using a DNN. So I'm working with Anna and Pantelis on this as my master's project. So as a quick introduction, maybe more for me than you guys, because I'm sure you're all aware of it, but while writing my thesis, I've been really trying to get to grips with the theory. So of course, neutrinos are massive objects, but they have very small masses, which we've seen by the baseline neutrino oscillation experiments. And one way we like to explain these masses is by using the seesaw mechanism. And to have these pseudo Dirac HNLs, we use this low scale inverse seesaw mechanism. And if we stipulate that they would have a similar Yukawa couplings to the electron, we can reasonably search in this sort of GeV range, which is where we perform this study between 10 and 80 GeV, with a mixing angle squared between 10 to the minus 1 and 10 to the minus 10. And we're searching in the final state that has exactly one electron and two jets. So you can see this lepton number conserving Feynman diagram in the bottom here. But just one of the possible final states. And then on the right here, there's an image sort of intuiting the premise of the seesaw mechanism. So in this Dirac scheme, you have very small Majorana masses, which lead to the small Standard Model neutrino masses, and heavy Dirac masses, which are possibly degenerate in the limit where the Majorana mass mu s is zero. And so how do we search for these at the FCCEE? Well, the FCCE is going to produce some 10 to the 12 Z bosons in its Z channel run. And this high luminosity pile-up free environment will be a really great detector environment to search for our signatures and possibly improve on the limits set by experiments such as LEP. And one of the really interesting features about some of the HNLs in the parameter space that we look is that if you look on the left here, as we approach the bottom left-hand corner of the parameter space, we end up having very long-lived particles due to the relation that the lifetime is inversely proportional to the fifth square of the mass and the square of the coupling. And so we can parameterize this with any of the sort of related parameters to the lifetime. In this analysis, we tend to focus on using the D0 or the D0 significance. And so for these mass points, there are some techniques we can try and use to sort of tease away the long-lived from the prompt decays and consider both, which is a really nice natural feature of the machine learning models we consider. And so in our analysis, we focus on three Standard Model background processes, the two centrally generated Z to BB and CC, and then one locally generated Z to full body decay, which we use in place of, for example, the Z to tau tau final state, which is what you see on the bottom left diagram there. And just to sort of say now, obviously, we're all aware that one of the big problems of studies like this at this stage is the very low luminosity of the production samples compared to what we're trying to model at the FCC. So on this top table here, you see the production luminosity for the BB and CC is around 10 femtobarb. And then for our centrally generated, for our locally generated samples, for example, the full body and the signal events, we have much higher luminosity. But what that means is that for this analysis, we focus on looking at 10 femtobarb, for which we have adequate statistics. And then only in the final result, we scale to 150 ettobarb. So, a summary of the cut and count study. The first part of this project has been to reproduce the cut and count as per Dimitri's thesis, which I've linked here. And after all the cuts, you see on the left that we have the invariant mass distribution for three benchmark mass points against the sum of the backgrounds, and you have three distinct peaks, as well as some peaks coming from the background. But mostly these three peaks where we can derive some significance, which is calculated from the equation on the right. And then projecting this across all the possible points in the parameter space, we get this delimitation around 10 to the minus 6 in the mixing angles, which is a really nice place to start. And we have on the right here a summary of the cuts. So we cut on the missing energy, the lead electron energy, the 3D Diger angle, and the Diger electron delta R. And we normalize to 10 femtobarn just using that equation there, where we're using the selection efficiency, the luminosity, and the number in the sample and the cross-section. So how do we optimize this? Well, the two natural follow-ons from a cut and count study might be to use a BDT or a DNN. And the really strong advantages here are that firstly, we don't have to make these sequential cuts on the variables, which might be correlated in some way, but instead we can just let the BDT or the DNN figure out nonlinear and complex relationships between the variables, categorize the events, and then we just make one cut on the BDT or the DNN score. And we keep all the events, background or signal, which have, say, a DNN cut of more than 0.8, something like this. And the other really good advantage is that we don't have to perform this cut and count on some benchmark variables and make global cuts, but instead we can train a BDT or a DNN for each individual mass point, which very naturally lends itself to exploiting features like the D0 and naturally separating the LLPs. And so the features we use to train our BDT and DNN are here on the bottom right. So we use lots of the leading electron variables such as the energy, the phi, the d0, the sigma of d0, et cetera, and then for the neutrino and Diger system. And then more recently, I think things that were added since the last presentation for the BDT are the sort of tracking related variables, so the number of tracks, the number of primary tracks, and the chi-squared of the primary vertex. And so the workflow for the BDT is such that we, I mean, as with most machine learning models, we have the stage one data preparation. So we load the n tuples that were generated via the stage one of the FCC analysis framework. We apply some filter to reduce the number of events. So from the cut and count, we see that the lead electron energy is a really nice filter to just reduce the ratio of background relative to the signal. And then we perform some split to the training and the test sets, and then we save them using TMVA as a root file. We pass these to the model training, where the hyperparameters of the BDT are optimized with the grid search. Then some decision trees are made, they're gradient boosted against each other to make predictions, and we save once again the model as a root file. And then the models are applied to this test set, normalized to a chosen luminosity, and we choose a BDT cut based only on calculating the significance and choosing the region which preserves the highest significance. So at the top here, you see an example of one possible decision tree. I like looking at these because they're very intuitive to understand. It's quite as you would expect for one single decision tree. You say, look at the missing energy. Is it greater or less than 29? Yes or no? And then it sequentially goes through other variables in order to make predictions on the probability that an event is signal or background. And then on the bottom right here, you see what it looks like to just have a raw classification in the background and the signal. So in the red, we have the background, and in the blue, we have the signal. In an ideal situation, you have all your events for signal at a prediction of one, all your events for background at a prediction of zero. But in reality, you have this sort of distribution that tails off for both the signal and the background, and you would end up making a cut above 0.9 and preserving the events that have a favorable background to signal ratio. So for the BDT result, it's quite different since the last time I presented. We have at points almost two orders of magnitude greater delimitation with the H&L couplings. And so if we look here and focus specifically on the 50 GeV mass point at 10 to the minus 6, you can see the raw classification on the top right. And then from here, we zoom into this so-called signal region between 0.9 and 1. We look at the distribution with a finer binning. And you can see here, because the BDT is performing really well and the peak at 1 is very much distinctly at 1 and not maybe at 0.9 as you zoom in, we can make a really, really strict cut of 0.999. And for this particular mass point, that preserves 13.5 signal events and just over one background event. We sort of, at this stage of the study, we're rationalizing the low yields, specifically in the background, just because we're only normalizing this to 10 femtobarn. So if we were working at the full statistics of the FCC, I think these yields would be acceptable. And so then for the DNN, just to sort of continue on this optimization trend. It's very much the same setup for the data preparation as the stage one. So this time, through experimenting with different filters, we actually apply at this stage a little bit of a harsher filter. So we have less events for the training and testing. So this is on the lead electron energy is greater than 20 GeV. And then instead of as a root file, we're saving the data sets in NumPy. And there's some feature flattening that takes place in order to have distributions for the variables that are centered between 0 and 1 rather than being over the full range, because this is easier for the DNN to interpret. For the model training, unfortunately, the biggest difference I would say so far between the DNN and the BDT in terms of the training is that the DNN has a lot more hyperparameters that you can experiment with, which in some ways is a good thing because it's sort of this endless process of being able to optimize. But unfortunately, unlike the BDT, it's not really possible to do a grid search because this would take a very long time. So instead, we do a random search for a given amount of trials, and we focus on things like the learning rate or the number of layers in the model. We then train the model for 100 epochs and target to minimize the validation loss. And then the final process is very similar in that we look at the raw predictions. We take a DNN cut that optimizes the significance, and we preserve these events that fall above the cut. So you can see actually from this distribution here that in terms of just its classification ability, the DNN is performing exceptionally well. It's arguably even better than the BDT at a specific threshold for separating the background and the signal. But if we look onto the result, unfortunately, what we see is that it's not currently quite as good at predicting the significance as the BDT, because when we zoom into the signal region, we have much less of a crisp peak and more of a smearing around 0.095 to 1. And so in this case, we have to make a looser cut of 0.986. And what that ultimately means is our significance suffers because we have to allow for more background events. And so lastly, then, focusing again on the BDT, one thing that was very natural to try was to include some D0 parameter in the filter itself in order to target long-lived and prompt decays. And so we see here on the left-hand plot, when we target these long-lived particles with the blue delimitation line, we see that we push slightly more into the parameter space, which at first was quite surprising that it wasn't more, because we're isolating the number of background events that are entering the training, and so you might think that it's able to find more distinct patterns with the signal. But if you look at the bottom right, when we're plotting the feature importance for each model trained, we see that already at this point, the model is starting to really effectively utilize the D0, and so we're not really able to push too far into that parameter space because we've naturally been able to find this relationship between the lifetime in the initial models. And then again, with the sort of cyan line for the prompt decays, we're not really seeing much delimitation improvement. But this is still a really nice check to ensure that the BDT is optimized properly for using these long-lived signatures. So, as a final comparison of the strategy, I've plotted here the two sigma delimitation for the cut and count, the BDT and the DNN. And so far, it seems like the BDTs elicit almost two orders of magnitude more in the couplings compared to the cut and count, whereas the DNN is only maybe around one order of magnitude. But at this stage, it's not really a robust claim to say that the BDT is necessarily better, especially as we saw that as a classification. And just in terms of the machine learning aspects, it's not necessarily a worse classifier, but instead we just need to focus on how we can make this very small signal region be more of a peak for the significance calculation. And it's still expected in these last few weeks that we can maybe optimize this line to match the BDT performance by possibly treating it as a multi-classification problem, because currently what we do is we treat all three backgrounds as one sort of soup of background and compare this to the signal in a binary classification task. But there are several attempts we can try as a multi-classification problem to see if that gives us better significance in the end for the DNN. As well as that, maybe more work on the hyperparameter optimization and the feature engineering can be done. So there's still lots of time to improve this result. So as a conclusion, if we look at our study in context, I have this plot on the left here, which appends the most recent CMS limit from a few months ago, as well as the 150 Atiban cut and count from Dimitri's thesis. This work is in red here from the BDT result, and then the projected FCC EE limit from the paper I've added here. And also at the bottom here, just the type one Seesaw limit, where we wouldn't expect to be able to push in this theory anyway. And it might be quite a surprising result to see that even with only around 50% of the branching ratio of the H and Ls, we are already cresting upon the FCC expected limit. I think it's fair to say that this is somewhat difficult to interpret without the related uncertainties if we're working with around 10 femtobarn of statistics and then scaling to the 150 attibarns. I think maybe it's worth some attempt to categorize what kind of systematic and statistical uncertainties we have here. But certainly what we can say from this plot is that this method using this BDT and hopefully in the end also using a DNN, we are much better at delimiting the parameter space than just using typical cut and count methods. So what's really important now for a study like this is one, to categorize the uncertainties, and two, to possibly try and find global filters in order to reduce the statistical uncertainties, so that we can make a more robust claim about the discovery potential at the full luminosity of the FCC. So thank you very much. I would be more than happy to take any questions because I have my thesis defense in some 3 weeks. So anything I don't understand properly would be very nice to get to grips with now. So thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Questions? I have a few, but other people can go first. Or I can ask if people are still thinking. Okay, on slide six.
Yes.
Right, you said you trained a separate BDT for each signal mass point. But you're varying the coupling as well. So do you also have a different training for different couplings?
Yeah, sorry. So that's maybe quite confusing wording. For this plot on the left, there's a model trained for each point here. So all 56 points have a
Ah,
trained
okay.
model.
So mass and coupling point. Okay,
Yeah.
cool. Just checking.
Yeah, sorry, it's just I worded it a bit confusingly.
No worries. I just wanted to check that. My main question about this was, I realize you showed it later on. This plot showing, I think, showing the most important variable for the BDT for each mass point. Does
Yeah.
that sort of change as you expect, given mass and coupling and other things?
Definitely the D0 is really nice to see. And the main reason I wanted to see these plots in the first place. So I should maybe explain quickly that the one on the left here is for the DNN and the one on the right is for the BDT. I think the D0 and the missing energy are both very expected. I think all we can really do when talking about like the missing energy theta or the lead electron energy here at 40 GeV times 10 to the minus 5 mixing is maybe speculate by looking at the distributions. But I would say that the main thing I think about when I look at these two together is just that the fact that the BDT is using more variables than the DNN is maybe just a sign that it's actually learning the patterns more effectively. Whereas on the DNN here, you see almost everything is just the missing energy, except for this long-lived particles region. But I would say mostly it's what you would expect. For example, in this low mass, low coupling region for the BDT, where we have the electron dijet being the most important, this is possibly just because we have very low mass H and Ls to produce this dijet electron final state, and so maybe these jets and the electron are quite collimated, and so this is more differentiable than for the higher mass points where the higher momentum into final states is going to give you more of a range in the electron digest system.
Okay, great. I think these plots are cool. So if you my recommendation, if you include them in your thesis or some other public thing, is that you make the font a little bigger because
Yeah, it's
old
quite
people
difficult
like
to read.
me can't see it.
Yeah, I can do that quite easily. So.
Thanks. I've got another question or two, but do other people have questions?
Maybe a silly one on this point of the. Can I ask Juliet or want to go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead.
So this point of low mass being boosted, do you? Because most likely in those cases, the electron identification will be harder, right? Because it will be inside the jet. So, and most likely you're probably using some flat identification efficiency independently on whether the electron is in or out, is in or out of the jet. So it would be, it would be interesting to see what's the, how much of an impact the electron ID would have in this case for an electron inside the jet.
I might be wrong in thinking this because this was introduced before I started my thesis, but I think that one of the things we maybe do differently to other central analysis is that we use our own jet reconstruction such that we exclude the electrons from the jet objects when they're formed. But this might be wrong, maybe.
Right, but no, this is probably correct. But the thing is whether you're able to distinguish an electron
I
inside a
see.
jet in the first place to veto it.
You are right, actually, Michele. So yes, this is actually something that we should investigate further, and I think this would be very interesting. Yes, thanks a lot for this suggestion, Maxim.
Okay, other questions? Maybe another dumb one for me. So on slide 13, this was like your conclusion slide. I'm just curious, can in case you include this plot anywhere or show it again, would you mind scaling the CMS result also to 150 inverse outer bounds? Just because
Yeah.
I can't do it in my head.
Yeah, for sure.
Thanks. I'm just curious to compare apples to apples.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is what we were discussing, actually, to just have a direct comparison for everything and don't just avoid any confusion, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, that could
Okay.
be interesting to see.
Cool. And then just one other question about sort of your plans. You said you're defending your thesis in about 3 weeks. And do you plan to make an FCC note and include this, for the feasibility study for the report?
I'm happy to do anything. So I think this is more dependent on Anna and Pantelis's plan with the work, but for sure I'd be happy to keep working on this in some capacity. It's quite interesting.
I think from our side, this is something that we can just pursue it further. I'm not sure, Anna, if you have any other opinion to that, but I think this is the plan.
Plus, I think any master's thesis can be easily made into an FCC note.
Okay, great. And we'll keep you in our account of notes planned. Awesome. Okay, any final questions for Tom?
Maybe another naive one,
Yeah.
if I can. The fact that you optimize the BTT also versus coupling, so I can see that the probably the only thing which will change for a fixed mass is whether the how is it called the HNL is long-lived or not, right? Is this
Yeah.
the only thing, or you expect so do you really need this BDT besides this BDT optimization versus coupling?
I think in the end, one of the good things about using machine learning in a space like this is that it doesn't really require any extra effort from our side to just submit the jobs to HTCondor or something and let it do a model for each. Because there maybe are some differences except for just the lifetime that the model will find that aren't necessarily intuitive to us by just looking at the distributions.
But did you have a look at the distributions and see if anything else besides the lifetime of the so probably what is the most impactful here is the displacement of electrons and tracks, I guess, right?
It would be interesting actually to see because for all of the distributions I've plotted on this slide, for example, this is three mass points that are fixed coupling. So I'm not actually 100% sure how these distributions change for a fixed mass and different coupling, other than like I said about the lifetime. But that would be really interesting to see.
Okay, cool.
Okay, great. Anything else? Not hearing anything. So thanks a lot, Tom. And we move
Thanks very
on to
much.
the next talk from Richards.
I'll share my slides.
Awesome.
Can you see them probably? Yeah. Cool. Hi everyone. Very happy to start iterating with you guys in these meetings. So today we'd just like to very briefly discuss our interest on looking into dark photon production in Higgs decays at FCCE. So I'd like to just like to start introducing the dark sector signature. So dark sectors are not new to the group. Light dark sectors are general, like are studied as general possibility in colliders, given that they offer minimal extensions to the standard model, dark matter candidate scenarios, and different exotic signatures. Particularly at the LHC, when light dark particles are produced with large boosts, these would cause the decay products to be collimated and form jet-like structures. These jet-like structures, or some of these jet-like structures, or the most popular ones, are usually referred to as lepton jets, which are simply a cluster of collimated light charged particles. This can be electrons, muons, or quarks. And these lepton jet-like signatures arise in dark sector models that are composed of these unstable particles with masses in the MeV-GeV range, where then these particles can decay to standard model particles. A clear example, for example, is this dark sector extension where we have an additional U1 dark symmetry, where we have an effective kinematic mixing between a dark photon and the standard model photon, allowing for the case where these dark photons are produced. Then they can mix with a standard model photon and decay to standard model particles, creating these lepton jet signatures. So I just want to very briefly let you know what we did or what we've done before for this lepton jet-like signatures in ATLAS, particularly in displaced lepton jet-like signatures in run-to-data, where we probed three different modes, production modes of the Higgs, and where we're also working on a run-three analysis iteration. So to very briefly tell you about the search that we did, we focused mainly on exotic decay of the Higgs, where the Higgs is decaying to two dark photons and possibly missing energy. This is done via the Higgs and vector potals, the one that I referred to before. It's the vector potal corresponding to the kinematic mixing between the dark photon and the standard model photon. We looked into three different production modes of the Higgs: gluon-gluon fusion, associated production with the W, and vectorversion fusion, and then into a couple of benchmark decay modes. That one called FRBZ, where you can see that two dark photons, where you can see that the Higgs decays to a couple of dark fermions that then radiate a dark photon each. And in the case of the HAHM, we don't have any additional dark fermion present in the signal, and we only have the production of two dark photons that then subsequently decay to a couple of fermions. This gives us, in turn, a final state of displaced lepton jet-like signatures with the possibility of additional missing ET. Here, where we can set the kinematic mixing parameter of the dark photon small enough such that we can ensure the dark photon is long-lived, and then if the dark photon is light enough with masses from 10 MeV to 10 GeV, we can ensure that the decay of the dark photon is going to be collimated. The actual decay of the dark photon depends on the mass of the dark photon, and this is also related to the c tau of the dark photon, such that we can prove by choosing different mass and c tau scenarios, we can prove different displacement and collimation scenarios as well. So regarding the displaced lepton jet signature, this is particularly the way that we define it in ATLAS. So we have this custom reconstructed objects that we call dark photon jets. So if I say DPJ, in the future, you know what I mean, where we are basically sensitive to decays of the dark photons that are after the Pixel detector. So beyond the outside, beyond the idea acceptance, we have two types of dark photons. One's called muonic DPJ, and the other one's called Kallo DPJ. In the muonic case, this is where the dark photon decays to muon antimuon. Again, we target decays that are outside the idea acceptance, and this is basically a signature of a pair of close by muon spectrometer only tracks with no matching tracks in the ID. And for the Kallo DPJ case, we target a decay in the hadronic calorimeter, That means that we are looking into low electromagnetic fraction jets with no matching tracks in the immunospectrometer spectrometer such that the two categories are exclusive. So that's our signal definition. So in this case, for the Kallo-DPJ, just to note, this category of Kallo-DPJ reconstructed object happens when we have both the decay to electron positron and to quarks. But this is only because the displacement of the dark photon is enough such that the energy deposited on the electromagnetic calorimeter is going to be low, and such we look at the reconstruction on the hadronic calorimeter. So our run-through results are basically we explored dark photon masses from 17 MeV to 15 GeV, and lifetimes that translate on a c tau from 2 to 1,000 millimeters. This c tau then times gamma and beta gives us a proper decay length such that we can make sure that the dark photons are indeed decaying in the fiducial volume of the detector. The plots that you can see on the right are basically our final branching ratio limits. And this is an upper limit on the branching ratio of the Higgs to this dark photon final state. So on the left, you have a dark photon mass of 1.1 GeV, and on the right of 10 GeV, the red curve dashed corresponds to the BBF combination. So it's the combination of all the channels that we define on BBF. And then we perform the combination of the BBF production mode with the previously explored gluon-gluon fission on WH to produce the Brazilian curve that you can see on the top plots. This is in general such that we can have an idea, or you guys can get an idea of what are the range of masses that we proved and the size of the displacements that we were targeting. These results are interpreted in exotic Higgs decay scenarios to long lead particles, and in general as dark sector models interpretations, where we have the FRBZ and HHM benchmark decays that I mentioned before. The caveat in this case is that the full combination that we performed in ATLAS for gluon-gluon fission, WH and BBF, is only FRBZ. And this is not ideal since FRBZ is not commonly used compared to other minimal models as HHM that are studied by many other people. To finish with this slide, I just want to mention that this upper limits on the branching ratio of the Higgs to this exotic decay translate then to a 2D exclusion limit as a function of the mass of the dark photon and the kinetic mixing parameter epsilon. So that's the ATLAS studies at a glance. But we are interested in looking if we can do something similar at FCCEE. So what we want to do is have a first look into dark photon production in Higgs decays at FCC. This goes complements really well with other ongoing FCCLP searches that are going in the group within the group. It's similar to display signatures coming from ALPs, like the displaced lepton pairs scenarios. And it also constitutes an additional exotic Higgs decay scenario on top of the long-lived scalar search that is currently ongoing as well. So for this, we are preliminary targeting FCC associated production with the SET boson. Plus the HHM Higgs decay benchmark, so such that our signal looks like this, where from each dark photon decay we get a DPJ-like signature. In this case, we have then associated production. For now, we've simulated the SET decaying to a couple of leptons, but we're open to considering also the decay to quarks. Given that we know that we have really good mass boson like recognition capability, and then we have the Higgs decays with a couple of dark photons. This is done at a center of mass energy of 240 GeV, and from this process, our experimental signature would be basically a reconstructed SET boson from a lepton pair or a quark pair, and a displaced dark photon jet from each of the long-lived dark photons, such that it looks roughly like this. In here, I try to emphasize that for the Kallo-DPJ case, we are targeting a reconstruction on the hadronic calorimeter, while for the muonic DPJ case, we are basically looking at
muon chambers information. So for our signal Monte Carlo and future plants, we whip simulated signals using the MatGraph HAHM viewer model. We have a couple of signals for different dark photon masses, both for 100,000 events per sample. What we're doing is we are generating the LHE files directly from MatGraph and then handing this to PTAblast Delphes using the IDEA Delphes card in order to have a full generator level sample. So for the actual samples that we have now, we have a couple. We have the first sample of dark photon mass 0.1 GeV with a displacement of 15 millimeters. In this case, for this mass, the branching ratio of the dark photon to it, well, the dark photon decays all the time to electron positron, such that this sample allows us to focus on color DPJ signatures. And then once we are the dark photon has a mass larger than 2 times the mass of the muon, the decay to muons opens up. And based on our mass and seed out choice, we can also be sensitive to mu DPJ signatures. In this case, our backgrounds, we have several candidates. We'll have like general inclusive ZH production, diboson production, and different samples that we are checking in the winter 2023 campaign. And here, our future plans are in parallel, do some generator level studies such that we can look at LHE level kinematics. And at the same time, look at the FCC analysis framework to study Ricco level information. This is quite important to us because we want to explore low level detector response, particularly color cluster information and muon information, including timing. And this is related to considerations that we have to have in mind regarding the displaced depth and displaced dark photon jet signatures. Since our reconstruction of the color DPJ, for example, is highly dependent on the level of simulation that we have from the calorimeters. Here, we think that, for example, the muonic dark photon jet final state is a safe option since it's easier to reconstruct. We can either do it as collimated muons in a narrow cone, or even consider the option of reconstructing resolved dipole muons with a simple vertexing. And then tentatively, we could also explore atlas-like neural network taggers to distinguish this displaced color DPJs from prompt lepton jets, given that we can work with the calorimeter simulation that we have now. But this is the general idea. So that's the prospect for the search. And this is what we're working right now. So that's it for me, at least for now. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot for this introduction to your at least to your plans. But I think you've got things already well underway with simulating the signal. Questions? Sarah.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for that. It was a really nice talk. This is really more a comment than a question, but I expect that you will be able to find the required backgrounds in the Winter 23 campaign, but I think we might end up hitting up against things we've seen in the other LLP samples about whether there's actually enough statistics if you want to really look at the unconventional signatures. Yeah, if there's anything that I can help with on that, I'm happy to chat further offline after.
Thanks, Sarah. I think that's actually quite relevant. From the experience that we got in Atlas, indeed, it's very hard to rely on Monte Carlo simulations for background prediction for this kind of signatures. We indeed did some data-driven background estimation for our results in Atlas. So if that's something that we'll keep in mind, and that's something that we could definitely chat about. So I really appreciate your comment.
Yeah, indeed. Sarah's dealing a lot with the Monte Carlo, especially for the BSM in general at FCC. So indeed, take advantage.
Yeah, I think
Yeah.
just to make sure. Oh, I mean, maybe we don't have to It's just a quick question, let's say, but would the option be in the case that we hit that wall and we see that we don't have enough Monte Carlo statistics to make a reliable prediction, the chance would be maybe to try to make a dedicated simulation or just to get a feel, let's say.
Yeah, I'd say that's an option.
Yeah, I think that there are probably a few things we could do. Sorry, Julia, I didn't mean to
No,
accidentally cut.
please.
I guess the good thing is you're going to look at your generator level stuff first. So you can probably make at least some kind of back of the envelope calculation of which selections are going to be useful from a signal perspective and maybe look at the backgrounds there. And there might be ways to use this, very early but evolving filtering framework just to
Okay.
maybe just at least check if we are getting background events in those areas of play space, even if we have to filter and we don't necessarily get a reliable estimate.
Yeah, okay, perfect. I think that sounds great. Thanks.
Okay, all this being said, you have to be aware that most of the Delphi sample will not have, of course, the low-level detector response information that you're looking for, right? So you might cut timing, but
Yeah, exactly. I think that's why I've been trying to do look at the SSE analysis framework in parallel. Given that that was one of the main things that we thought at first, given that we need that kind of information for the Calo DPJ signatures. But I think something that I tried to express here as well is that even beyond the information that might be available at Ricoh level for the Calo DPJ signatures, we are fairly confident that we can at least study the mu DPJ signatures properly, given that this is considerably easier to implement and to define the objects and like that information. I believe that it's indeed available. So we'll see. At least we have a backup plan, let's say, a reliable signature that we know that we can look at.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first step would be to understand what Sarah said, how many at least displaced jet candidate you get from ZDKs, from TAOs, and these kind of things already. Not
Yeah,
the problem,
exactly.
the real physics based one, and then fakes are probably something you will have to study in full sim anyway.
Onion.
So I think that the full detector related information, I think this might be a physics object level of study. So in principle, we don't need the dedicated processes because one of the main thing is to understand what is the rejection factor for a prompt jet. So in this case, we can have other samples, for example, even if some possibly single particle. Or just some inclusive quark-quark production so that we can just use that as as an object level, and then we can make some, if that's possible, to find such samples. I think that would be good. So.
It's definitely possible. It depends then what kind of rejection efficiency you expect, I mean, or you need. But I think it's definitely feasible to produce order, 100K to 1 million full sim Z2QQ events. That's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in principle we don't. Yeah, perfect. I think we can also use some of our information of the Atlas current objects and get an understanding of that. I think the level of rejection we're looking at probably on the order of 3 or 4 orders of magnitude at this stage. But if it's inclusive Z2J in the quark sample, we should be okay at that level. Then a physics level of let's say working point of efficiency versus rejection can then be used to for the realistic backgrounds to extrapolate some guesstimate of the numbers, and that could be an option if, for example, the ZHZZZ quark samples are limited by statistics in that case.
Other comments or questions? Maybe just two silly ones for me. So indeed, if you need to find that you want to do some simple displaced vertex, I can point you to Magda and the other people at Uppsala. They've been working a lot on displaced vertices, so they could probably help. So if you need their contact, let me know.
Thanks, I appreciate it. That's the long loop scalar search, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the exotic kings one. Yeah. So just ping me if you can't find their other emails.
Yeah, thanks.
And then since you're ramping up now, maybe it will be too soon to say that you'll have a final result for September, but maybe you can still be included in the feasibility study. I mean, in the report, with like a preliminary write up with like, you know, hints of things that can be working that can work without, you know, necessarily having a final result, but some beginnings, whatever you have by then, maybe that can still be a goal to be included by September.
Yeah, I think we are happy to just to still trying to aim for that, but we are also happy to go beyond the report, let's say.
Absolutely, I imagined that would be your plan. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks.
But I just didn't want you to think, September, there's no way, we can't do anything. But I'm thinking you might be able to do a little something by then.
Yeah, yeah, no, thanks. I appreciate that.
Sweet. Okay, other comments or questions? Okay, I'm not hearing any. So thanks, Richards. And thanks, Tom, and everyone for connecting. Any other business before we close? No meeting next week. And I don't think I have anyone in the plan for following week. So let me know if you want to give a presentation.
Juliet, sorry,
yeah.
Just to ask a question about this. Maybe what we could do in a couple of weeks' time, if there's energy for people to do it, is actually, I guess, have a recap within our group about our possible to-do lists in respect of what's presented at FCC week.
Okay.
Because I don't know, like, are you going?
I'm not, unfortunately.
Yeah, because I guess if we can find someone who is there, who's been following these discussions, you know, maybe Rebecca will go or something, I think that could be quite nice. Because some of the meeting is going on at like slightly antisocial times in this time zone, but discussing what we think we need to be thinking about ahead of the summer in lieu of that could be quite good.
Okay, yeah, good idea. I think Louise is giving a talk on BSM at the FCCEE next week, and she's in principle connected with all of us. So maybe she can simply give that talk again, and that's maybe the starting point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just again, it can be a relatively open agenda item, but it might be that either follow-ups or things that might be good for us to discuss.
Okay, great.
Fab, thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay, great. Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you next time. Have fun at FCC week if you're going.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Thank you.